Time now for History Matters. Because sometimes we could all use a break from the present, we are joined in the studio by Scott Washington, Hillsborough historian extraordinaire, to break down this week in history. How are you?
Well, doing good. And you know, you're so right. It's like time travel. You go back in history, it's like taking a break for a moment. And yet, you look at stuff and you go, oh my gosh, it has a connection with the present.
Mm.
And that's true this week too. Of course, this is the week when we have 9/11, the 18th anniversary, the hijackers in New York and the buildings. But sneak attacks are not unknown to America, whether it's Pearl Harbor or Fort Sumter. I mean, there have been attacks on this continent. Or we might even go further back, and the people coming to this country, whether it was Africans forcibly kidnapped, brought here 400 years ago, and forced into forced labor. Yeah, there's many instances of sneak attacks, but what is also fascinating to discover is how resilient Americans are to events and taking and turning around bad events and turning them into something good when possible. And I think that's kind of one of the other things that we get out of history. But it's but like you said, it's such a great vacation. If you can't get down to the coast or the mountains, just go back in
just
history.
Just go back in history.
It is so engaging.
And if you just stay right in place, eventually where you stand is going to be both a coast and a mountain and everything in between.
That's right. Well, and here we have Hillsborough. You know, and Hillsborough has a mountain, the Okanichee Mountain, the highest natural point between here on the coast, half a billion years old, about the same epoch as the Appalachian Mountains. I went up with a Swiss geologist who used the Socratic method and would always ask, what is it? No matter what you answered, he'd say, wrong. And everybody's so intimidated that I am going to learn so much. But he loved that
mountain.
Are
you supposed to learn from the Socratic method? You just learn that you're wrong about this and that and the other thing.
Well, it makes you a little humble and you go, oh, yeah. Well,
you learn humility.
That's
okay,
right.
I get it.
It was very fascinating to learn so much about it. And if people haven't, this is a great place you can go up. Has a beautiful overlook at 10 minutes going up a ranger access road, an overlook that looks almost for hundreds of miles. It's really dramatic. And then winding trails that go around it. One of the world's largest deposits of pyrophyllite, a soft, chalky rock that's used with ceramics, heat resistant, maybe NASA. NASA's not talking, but it's still being mined today. So it's kind of really interesting stuff. And one right where the overlook, which
that
is
an interesting little detail you just kind of threw in there and moved
right
on.
I looked this up and I'm like, really? This is really interesting. Like, mum's the word. But what is really interesting, too, is that you have where the overlook is, which is on granite, but in front of it was built on pyrophyllite. So guess what? At one point, many years ago, not that many, like within the last 20, the whole side of the mountain slid off.
Oh, no.
Now, as far as we know, there were no casualties, but still, people have told me, oh, yeah, we used to climb up that side.
That now just doesn't exist.
That does exist. Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, a little bit. You can get up there, and you'll find some of this stuff. It's available, and if you feel like you're Superman or Superwoman, you can break it off in your hands.
Interesting.
So it's interesting. So, but Hillsborough pops up because this is one of my favorite dates, 1781, September 12th, 1781, today, is when, this is towards the end of the Revolutionary War, and there is this loyalist named David Fanning, very fierce, no connection with the Edmund Fanning of Hillsborough fame and Regulator fame, as far as we know, except for the name, but he goes in with a force of loyalists when he realizes the main body that's guarding this provincial capital of North Carolina, where the governor and the cabinet are, and basically kidnaps them.
Wow.
And there's an actual Revolutionary War battle that happens there. People are killed defending Hillsborough. One of those was named Thomas Freeland, who was actually related to a later Freeland, James Freeland, who builds the iconic Daniel Boone Village.
Interesting.
Which is really fascinating. So there really were people defending Hillsborough. There's battles. They take refuge in the church that was on the corner where the museum is now and the Hillsborough Presbyterian Church, no longer there, but the first St. Matthew's. But this really does happen.
What then happened to the governor? And
good question. Well, that brings us to the next day, September 13th.
When I'm looking at this, like, what's the connection
exactly
here?
Well, okay, the next day, when the militia realizes, which had been out of Hillsborough looking for loyalists, when they realized the governor had been captured, they went in pursuit. Mm-hmm. And they confront them at Lindley's Mill, and there's a battle that goes on, epic battle, one of the largest at the end of the war in this part of North Carolina, and they don't defeat Fanning and his men. The governor gets taken down to Wilmington and then to St. James Island in South Carolina, where he remains a prisoner.
Wow.
Now, the war technically ends in 1781 with the defeat of Cornwallis, but as we know, peace treaties don't get signed for another 2 years, so there are people kept on board these atrocious places, whether it's ships or in this case an island. And according to the tradition about this, Burke was under fear for his life from other loyalists, and so he makes his escape. Now, today we would say, oh, that is great, but this is the difference. Back in that time, your word is your bond. Mm-hmm. And if you break it, oh my gosh, that was, and he can't recover. He comes back as governor and lets the British know, hey, I've done this, but I'm still serving out. And eventually the British say, you're fine, but he can't live it down here because he broke his word.
Wow.
It's almost like, you know, we look at what happened yesterday in the North Carolina Assembly, and that's why there's such uproar. But it really goes back to the word is your bond, and when you break that, it just breaks trust in a
profound way. And in this case, the word is, I agree to remain as prisoner on this island.
Even though my life might be in danger,
and
that's when he realized things had changed and he escapes. And I think any of us would, but it just shows you how different things are. In fact, going further back to 1771, when Governor Tryon launches his attack against the Regulators, and then says, all right, anyone who comes in wants to escape the fate of people being either executed as traitors or anything else, they need to pledge their allegiance, and so many do. But they end up, actually, it's a miscalculation. The British think, ah, we've got all these loyalist support. They don't. They actually have a lot of people who said, no, well, I'm not going to fight on either side. Or they do. Those who do actually go west and they fight in the Battle of King's Mountain. And
interesting.
Other things. Yeah, so it's really, really interesting to see how this is why, isn't it great? Anybody who's listening right now say, this is a great vacation. I never knew there was a connection.
There's also something really interesting about studying the history of these kind of early American wars. And the American Revolution is one, War of 1812. We really get this in the Civil War, because this is another war where the war ends, but there are several armies and different negotiations, including the one up in Durham at Bennett Place, because there wasn't an American army. There were many different local armies or militias that were kind of cobbled together, and that was the case here. And that's something that we don't even, it's difficult for us to process now, because today's army is so different from the way they conceived it 150, 200 years ago.
Well, and you bring up a good point, because we always think of Appomattox as being the end of the Civil War when Robert E. Lee surrenders. However, the way the Confederacy had organized their armies were kind of self-standing independent units. So you had General Joe Johnson, a Confederate general, who had an army. And this is after Appomattox, and he's still out in the field. Sherman has pursued him. They're in this area. And there is no Durham at that point or Chapel Hill. There's this Hillsborough area. That's where Johnson is camped out. Sherman's in Raleigh. They agree to meet right around the same time that Lincoln is going to Ford's Theater. And that's when, of course, the news comes down. Sherman has the discipline, and I don't know how he did have the discipline to do this, swears the telegraph operator's secrecy, and then first person he tells about Lincoln's assassination is Joe Johnson, who realizes the catastrophe. These guys try to come to some terms. Again, when Washington hears about it, they're dealing with a real conspiracy, and so they say, enough. You know, they send Grant down to take over. They don't know what's going on. And when Grant comes down, he quickly understands, hey, it's got to be the same terms as Appomattox. There's no kind of, you go back to the status quo. And that leads to the largest troop surrender of the war on April 26th, the same day that Booth is captured, caught, and killed. which overshadows this tremendous event. And you can go to Bennett Place in Durham, and this is just to record the very same thing what we're talking about, which is there are all these other aspects.
Yeah.
And right here in this area is such a rich reservoir of history. It's a great way to take a vacation, whether it's in Durham, going to Bennett Place, or going to Hillsborough,
yeah,
where if you're in the historic district, the streets are in the same location with the same street names as a map of 1768 you can see in the visitor
center. You can stand in place and go back in time, just like we said.
Yes, it is. You really do feel like, oh my gosh, I've really taken a vacation, gone to Colonial Williamsburg without the distance it costs for the travel.
Speaking with Scott Washington, History Matters, a couple more. What else we got?
Okay. Well, here's one that's kind of interesting, and these are a couple of creative ones. But let's see. We've mentioned about the War of 1812. Yeah, in 1814... Francis Scott Key goes out to a warship where a physician is being held, and he pleads for his release. The British are planning to launch a battle against, of all places, Baltimore, the place that has been so put down and is the scene of where I think some Republicans are meeting tonight and the president is going to meet. Well, he's aboard the ship. They won't let him leave. They launch the attack, and then the next morning is when he sees what he calls the Star-Spangled Banner. The flag is still waving, which you can go down to the National Archives in Washington and see for yourself. But he writes this poem, and the interesting thing about it is, too, we think of, like, the 1956 is when In God We Trust declared to be the motto. But actually, it's in the fourth stanza of the poem of the Star-Spangled Banner, written in 1814. Isn't that interesting?
So
I did not know that.
Right.
Yeah, a little kind of
fun
fact.
No one knows the second or the third or the fourth verses of the Star-Spangled Banner.
The fourth verse has this line, this is our motto, in God is our trust.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting? I always thought it was reactionary.
The third verse is the one that gets controversial, right?
Yes.
That's right. Everyone remembers the first, and then it just goes on.
It's hard enough singing the first verse.
Remembering the lyrics, getting the music right, it's a very difficult song to sing. We make it very difficult on ourselves, and then we make it even more difficult by winning all those gold medals.
But and I have to say that it comes down to sometimes these individual people that make a difference. And we've said this before, a couple of birthdays this week. Margaret Sanger, 1879, who is the American birth control advocate. She actually coins the term birth control and opens up this whole new era for a century, which changes everything for women and men, which is a great thing. Also, this is the week when Colonel Sanders was born. And the reason why that's kind of interesting is because we think, and the common legacy of Colonel Sanders is, it was only when he's 65 that he starts this. Well, actually, that's true in one sense with the franchising. But I found evidence that going back to the 1930s, where he was successful with his recipe.
Oh, no.
Yes.
No.
1939
is in a guidebook.
This
is the story that we tell ourselves when we're getting older and we haven't achieved our dreams. It's okay.
Right.
Colonel Sanders was 65.
That's all right, but it's still true because he has this restaurant. It works really well. It's very successful in Kentucky. There's even a North Carolina connection. He even bought a motel in Asheville, but eventually he has to sell it. So it doesn't necessarily, these don't go that far, but he's renowned as this restaurateur. And then at 65, he starts thinking about this as a franchise, and that's what changed. With $105 from Social Security, he realizes, I can't make it on this. And he goes out and begins literally sometimes sleeping in his car and selling this until he's so successful internationally that eventually he sells the rights to the Kentucky Fried Chicken, but he is retained as a spokesman and, of course, as the model for many, many years afterwards. And he would oftentimes go into a restaurant. If it wasn't up to his standards, there are reports he would throw the food on the ground. I mean, this is a guy
in Kentucky Fried Chicken, an actual Colonel Sanders with the hair and the weird beard and the mustache comes in and starts, like, carrying on and throwing a fit and throwing food
on
the floor.
That's it. I'm done.
That is the Facebook post that is going to get more likes and reactions than anything else.
Isn't that interesting? I thought that was one of the more interesting stories. He had a real dispute with the corporation about how they made gravy. He loved his gravy recipe, But the corporation said it's too complicated. They simplified it. He never completely was at peace with that.
I come home. Brad's like, how was your day? I'm like, let me tell you what happened to me.
And you thought you had problems. Yeah. It's nothing like that.
Speaking with Scott Washington, we got time for one more. We're going to talk about Charles Kuralt's birthday. Right?
Charles Kuralt, thank you very much this week. That's right. And, of course, Charles Kuralt is a famed CBS newsman who has an astonishing connection with a fabled radio station.
That'd be this one.
Best in the world. It contributed to world radio history. That's right, WCHL.
Because he interned here.
He worked here
for a while.
Yeah, which I think is really exciting. And I think, you know, you carry on that same kind of interest and interviewing and finding fascinating stories. You yourself do. And, of course, everybody else does in so many ways makes this one of the great stations. And the fact that Charles Kuralt had a connection with it makes this truly fabled. And that's just as fabled as Michelangelo, who made that statue of David 6 tons, and they can't move it, so they leave it in place.
Thank goodness. Bring the tourists here.
Yes, they should. And they can. They can come here to University Plaza and look through the windows and see the action being made, radio being made live every day. It's so exciting.
And that is History Matters. Scott Washington, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, Eric.